stories to you.
Hello, my name is Rosemary Milsom, and I'm the founding director of the Newcastle Writers Festival. Australian readers love a good crime novel, and in this session, which was recorded at the 2023 festival, Anna Downes talks to three writers about their critically acclaimed debut books. New Blood, Crime Writers to Watch, includes Matthew Spencer, Shelley Burr, and James Mackenzie Watson.
It's an Australian gothic psychological thriller. It is about a nine-year-old boy named Parker who's growing up in central west New South Wales, who is worried that there's something wrong with his brain. And this something is apparently confirmed when he does something abhorrent as a child. Years later, Parker comes back to the bush to go on a camping trip with old friends, but this camping trip becomes the termination point for a lifetime of guilt and fear, and Parker finally has to reckon with what he did as a child in the context of his own fatherhood.
Bravo, such good summaries. And that is quite hard to do as well, isn't it? It's quite difficult, but I think a lot of you, all of you have had quite a lot of practice by now with that, so well done. Let's talk about characters. Shelley, as I was saying to you in the green room earlier, I feel like Wake feels super fresh to me. It's a, as you said, you know, it's kind of like a small town mystery. But it marries that and that the landscape with technology as well. It feels very current in that way. And another reason that it feels very fresh is that the characters, your two main protagonists, are just so nuanced and well-rounded, and they feel so true to life. Why don't you tell us a little bit about them both, about Mina and Lane, and without giving too much away, maybe just a little bit about what's at stake for them both when we meet them.
Yeah, certainly. So with Wake, it's written in two points of view. So we have occasionally chapters that are narrated by Mina, who is this adult woman who suffered a significant traumatic loss when she was young, and has come to the point in her life where she thinks that all of the attention on the case, all of the international media, all of the amateur sleuths trying to solve it, they've really done more harm than good. It's been very invasive and very traumatic, and has never actually gotten her anywhere near any kind of answer about what did happen to her sister. And so she really wants to just close that box and live her life. whereas some other chapters are narrated by Lane Holland, who is an outsider in town. He is a private investigator who specializes in cold cases. And how he makes his living is that he attempts to crack cases with large rewards attached to them. So he approaches Mina, presenting himself as someone who is interested in the record-breaking reward attached to solving the disappearance of Evelyn McCreary. But they're both very troubled characters who have experienced significant losses in their life. And in a lot of ways that attracts them to each other and also repels them as well. It's a really complicated arrangement between the two, of Lane trying to win Mina's trust and also at the same time maybe not necessarily deserving it.
Yeah, and that the way that you portray that sort of push and pull, it does feel, it's so subtly done, you really kind of feel it as well, and you know, by the end, you're completely understanding why it happens. It's very well done. James, Denizen is so rooted in character, isn't it? It's. I would say it's kind of all character. And one of the reasons that I loved it so much, and I really, really loved it, is the incredibly intimate, immersive experience of being so wholly inside Parker's head. I completely empathized with him. I was with him the whole way, which kind of makes certain events that take place a little bit later down the line quite problematic and a bit difficult. Can you describe Parker in a little bit more detail and just exactly why you wanted to write him that way?
So at the beginning of the book, as I said, Parker's a nine-year-old boy who's growing up on this remote property, locked in terrible power battles with his parents, a very emotionally troubled and disturbed kid who grows into a pretty emotionally troubled adult. a lot of the early drafts of Denison is essentially, it's a book about mental illness, and that was what I always wanted it to be about. It came from a place of me wanting to try to explore things that I'd seen, felt, been privy to growing up in rural New South Wales myself, and I wanted to write about mental illness in the bush and about the way it manifests and affects people and is perpetuated. And so I wanted to try to write a character who is, you know, at times through the book really struggling with mental distortion and mental illness, but write it in such a way that the reader could follow all the way through to the end, because my goal was to hopefully paint a picture of a character and a family where it's not, you know, the character and their mental illness against the world, but it's the mental illness against the character and the world. And in order to do that, I needed to try to describe in great intimacy and detail this character's point of view, so that you were there in his head and being able to feel the pain of what he's feeling in such a way that you can empathise with it, because you need to be able to do that to, in order to go to some quite dark places and for him to do some quite dark things. And I think the best example in all of literature, and I noticed that there's a quote from this novel at the start of Matthew's book, is Lolita. Lolita is an incredibly dark, difficult novel, but it's told so squarely from the point of Humbert that you get to the end of that book and you think, shit, have I been groomed as well by this character from reading this book? And it's because, you know, Nabokov does this incredible job of putting you so squarely in Humbert's mind that you get to the end of the book and you almost feel sympathy for him, and then you feel dirty for having felt sympathy for him. But that's such a powerful tool in trying to convey difficult points of view, I think.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And actually, weirdly, this is an odd thing to admit in light of what you've just said, but I read that book when I was, like, 17, and I thought it was deeply romantic. Like, isn't that awful?
So he's done his job then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I did, and I remember.
And you look back, and you're like, that's a book about a child abuser. But you look back at it as an adult, and you're like, this is a book about child abuse.
Oh my God, completely.
And that's such a powerful, use of that technique to pull you so deeply inside a character that you find yourself empathising with, you know, probably one of the worst characters in all of literature.
Oh my God, I couldn't agree more. But also how interesting it is that a book can, because obviously at that age I didn't have any I didn't have the frame of reference to understand what it was actually about. And then so, you know, how different books can resonate with you at different points in your life. Anyway, I digress. Thank you for that. Matthew, it's a common fact that writers often put a great deal of themselves in their first novels, and certainly there are very many echoes of your own life in Black River. Adam Bowman is one of two main protagonists, and he's a journalist who grew up in the grounds of an elite boarding school, as did you yourself. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about to what extent you drew on your own experiences to build this character and, of course, the setting?
Yeah, so Bowman is a sort of 48-year-old struggling, not very good journalist on the night shift of a dying national newspaper. So I'm not sure where I got that idea, but and I think what I did with him, there are aspects of myself in Bowman, but there are aspects of myself in other characters in the book as well, which is probably what a debut writer does. There's a second main character who's a sort of 35-year-old female homicide detective and sort of the antithesis of Bowman. But there's little bits of me in her as well. And of course, in the book, there's a family at the school with a 15-year-old child growing up on the school, the son of a chemistry teacher. And in a way, maybe that's me as well, which is an interesting sort of thing to think about. But yes, I definitely did mine parts of my life. And with Bowman, what I did, why I wrote him as a journalist was that I had 20 years of experience. So I knew what a newsroom, how a newsroom functioned. And it is set at a school, but it's a set when it's empty, because I've never worked in a staff room. So I didn't actually want to make it a campus novel in that way and go into a staff room, because then anyone who's been in it, in a staff room, will look at it and say, well, it doesn't really work like that. So the reason a journalist is, so I suppose I could put parts of myself into him, but also just that sort of knowledge of how his industry works, and then the way that the journal, the media and the police will rub up against themselves in an investigation such as the one in the book.
Yeah, and the deserted nature of the school is really interesting as well. There's not the kids running around, there's not the bells, there's not the classes, like it's just this kind of desolate place and how extraordinary that is. I think that was a really... Did you grow up... You would have had heaps of experience with that. That must have been a cool time as a kid.
It was a great place to grow up, and I had a wonderful... It's basically the King School, North Parramatta. The name's been changed, but anyone who knows it, it's obvious, like the first chapter tells you how to get there. so there's no denying it. I grew up there and had a wonderful upbringing because there were probably... It's 400 acres, there's remnant Sydney bushland, there is a creek which is one of three tributaries to the Parramatta River that runs through the back of the place. And there's probably housing for 30 families, so teachers, and so there were children my age there. So it was quite an idyllic childhood, which I've now besmirched with this...
besmirched it.
This tale, yeah.
You've got a second protagonist, main character as well, Rose Riley, and she's a police detective. Tell us a little bit about Rose.
So as I say, she's a bit like Lane in Wake. She's an adjustment, I suppose, to Bowman, and they're so different, and they can work off each other. Bowman, I wouldn't call him bumbling, but he lacks confidence and this sort of thing, which I think in this genre is an interesting thing to have a sort of a lead character who's actually, you know, has no superhero qualities or anything, and I think that Riley is different to that. She's very driven. She's very good at her job. She's a single white female, really, and she has a relationship with another detective who's male and her superior. But there's a lot of trust in that relationship, and they get on very well. So in the end, I think it's an anti-journalism book, but sort of a pro-police book.
Which is interesting in a time when there's kind of slightly less trust in the police, maybe. We might circle back to that later. Let's talk about inspirations for the book. I mean, talking of semi-autobiographical first novels, James, I know that Denizen is 100% a work of fiction, but I have heard you talk very eloquently about the ways in which writing this book for you was emotionally very cathartic. Could you tell us a little bit about that in whatever way you're comfortable?
So this is a really important thing to stress. It is 100% a work of fiction, and anyone who reads the book will understand why that's so important to stress. Yeah. And anyone who opens the book will understand why the very first thing they'll see is a dedication to my mum that says, "For my mum, whose unconditional love saved me." Because the relationship at the core of the novel is a really fractured, fragmented relationship between a mother and a child. I grew up in Central West New South Wales. I moved to Sydney. I didn't finish high school. I left school when I was in year 10 because I hated it. And, you know, I was 6'2", and my mum couldn't physically put me in the car and take me to school, so I stopped going. I mean, looking back on it, I was a really mentally unwell teenager and needed a lot of support and a lot of help that just wasn't available in that setting. And I moved to Sydney, I started studying nursing, I found a job that I loved, I found people that I loved, you know, I kind of flourished in a way that it just seemed impossible when I was a teenager. And then I got to 21 or 22 and, you know, I'd been writing my entire life anyway and thought, I want to try writing a long-form novel. And I wrote a couple of manuscripts in quick succession, which, on the one hand, I look back at them all now, and they're all the same novel. They're all, there's a sad boy in the bush with, you know, various twists on that. But I wrote Denizen for therapy, not because the stuff that's in Denizen is anything that happened to me. Again, I can't stress that enough. I'd be in prison if that was the case. But because I came away from my adolescence in the bush just feeling so angry and confused about things that had happened there, specifically about the way mental health was responded to there and the way the isolation and other factors in the bush, and you know, a poorly functioning healthcare system had made things so much worse. But more than that, it was the number of people that I knew or you know, had known since I'd moved back, moved to Sydney, who had either killed themselves or been victims of, you know, family violence that was born out of isolation and remoteness. And it felt really, I think writing Denizen was very much me trying to expunge that anger about that and about those, you know, what I perceived as injustices. And it's been really interesting, you know, Denizen took 6 years to come to gestation from that first draft through to it winning the Penguin Literary Prize. And in those 6 years, I think I grew up, well, I know I grew up immeasurably. I was an angry child, really, when I wrote the first draft. I'd like to think I was a much more nuanced, mature 28-year-old by the time it won the prize. And I hope that that comes through in the book, that there's that anger, but there's also that sense of everyone is doing their best. These awful things that happen are not necessarily anyone's fault. You know, when I, as I say, when I, the inspiration was I wanted to write because it made me feel better, and bizarrely other people seem to want to pay to read that, and that's quite okay. But it was certainly something I wrote first and foremost for me.
Oh, and it is, it's so powerful. It's so powerful. Shelley, we could do a whole session, I think, on the settings of each of these novels. They are so rooted in their environments and their landscapes. And they're so beautifully and vividly described. But the town of Nanin and the surrounding landscape is especially vivid in my mind. I think just recently I went to Cooma to a writer's retreat, and I think, I don't know, like that kind of, I have those rolling hills and that sort of remote setting in my head when I was reading it. But why did you choose this particular landscape for this particular story, and what's your own personal connection with the land of that region?
Yeah, certainly. So Nanin is a fictional town. I was very deliberate that I didn't think it was appropriate for me to take a real place and layer a fictional, awful history over it. Because Nanin is, I mean, to use a cliche, it's almost one of the characters at this point, is that everybody in town has been in some way affected by the tragedy that happened there. And that is a really key element of the story. And so it didn't feel fair or reasonable to take a real place where real people live and put the story there. You know, you don't want the Forks Washington effect where people are turning up wanting to take pictures. But it is based on a real place because I wanted that sense of authenticity, and I also needed to be able to check things for myself of, you know, would it be reasonable for it to have a school? How many police officers would it be likely to have? How long does it take to drive to Sydney? So it is based on a real place, which for a long time I didn't disclose because it's a little egotistical, but I really enjoyed it when people tried to guess. But one thing that was fascinating is that the guesses were always very far east of where I had actually placed it. And a person finally successfully guessed it in Boorowa in New South Wales when I did an event there. And I was quite chuffed because it was a person from the area who'd recognised it. And the town is actually Ivanhoe in New South Wales. So yeah, it was a real place. Unfortunately, my intention was that I really wanted to get out there and visit and do a, you know, spend a couple of weeks there, you know, get all of those tiny details, the smells and the sounds. But then COVID hit and the area was very badly hit, and it was just not appropriate for someone to come from a city and go visit this town in the midst of a pandemic just for research. My intention when designing the setting was I started with this idea of just, I was just fascinated by this idea of this girl who had grown up as the sibling of one of those famous murder victims that everybody knows their name and everybody talks about them. And that just seemed like such a fascinating and overlooked perspective in crime fiction of the families of the victims and the way that they have to live with that loss. and also the trauma of this intense attention. So I started with that, and I was just trying to design a crime that would be fascinating enough that it would get that level of attention. And so this idea of this very isolated house where it just seemed completely impossible that a child could just evaporate with no clues left behind, no idea how it happened, just they're just gone. It was almost in my mind like this, almost like a boat on the ocean. As a kid, I was quite obsessed with stories like the Mary Celeste, of those boats that they just found abandoned and no sign of what happened to the people on board. So I knew that it had to be very isolated and very remote. And so I essentially just started searching for places that, you know, that felt right for the story that I was setting. I, as mentioned in my bio, I spent a lot of time in Glenrowan growing up. My grandparents had a property there. I used to say that they had a farm there, but you know, even though it had like livestock and orchards and 40 acres and so forth, they got really upset with me for describing it as a farm. It's like a stolen valor thing, that they're not real farmers. You know, the real farmers are the guys that have 1,000 acres and, you know. A property. Yeah. So it was quite a long negotiation with them when they came to me and they said, look, you can't keep calling it a farm. It wasn't a farm. So we finally came to an agreement that I would call it a property. But as a kid, I would spend so much time there just roaming, just wandering around these paddocks because, you know, it was just kind of like you'd have your breakfast and they'd turf you out and come back when you're hungry. And that feeling of walking those fields and the way that it sounded and smelled and the crunch of grass underfoot and just that moment of looking up and looking around and realizing that there might not be another human being within a 2 kilometer radius of you, and just the stillness and the silence and the complete isolation, those sorts of distant places, it makes everything that little bit more complicated and that little bit more dangerous. Everything has to be so intentional because you can't just pop to the shops for a bit more milk. You have to be thinking all the time, what's in the cupboards, what's in the fridge, what's coming out of the garden, how much water is there in the tank, and how long will that last us? And if something goes wrong, getting help is a very complex issue. Like, you know, it has to be a helicopter or an aeroplane.
I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because my next question is, in your acknowledgements, you say thank you to the Westpac helicopter. There's a scene in Wake where this happens, where somebody gets into some real trouble and they have to get a helicopter over to rescue them. And in Shelley's acknowledgement, she says, thank you to the Westpac helicopter who rescued me when I was the one who got in trouble in some long grass in a very remote spot. Tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. So it's a funny thing that, James, you were talking about how books, you know, they're quite often autobiographical while also being 100% fictional. And so I wrote this scene in which a character does get bitten by a snake. And it's a narrative turning point that it drives the plot forward and it brings the characters together. And when I was in the very early stages of the draft, and the only person in the world who knew anything about this book was my husband, and he very offhandedly commented to me, look, I'm really looking forward to getting to the bit with the snake bite, because that happened to you, so it'll be really realistic. And until that moment, I had completely forgotten that that was an autobiographical scene. It had just come up subconsciously. Like, I mean, obviously I've never forgotten that I was bitten by a snake, but I'd never consciously sat down and said, I'm going to write this scene because this thing happened to me and that'll be really cool. But the way that it happened to me in real life was much less dramatic than it occurs in the book. I was bitten by a black snake, which is a much less dangerous snake. And I was at Lostock at a scout camp. So literally every adult in the vicinity was trained in first aid and snake bite, and how to deal with a snake bite. So I was very rapidly assisted, but because of our location, I was transported to the John Hunter Hospital on the Westpac rescue helicopter. And I wanted to give them a nod in the book that it would be the Westpac rescue helicopter. Yeah. But they don't work in that area. I actually looked it up, and it's the Royal Flying Doctor Service.
Oh, no! You thanked the wrong people! Oh, my God.
So it is correct in the book, and then in the acknowledgements, thank the people in real life. But they're both amazing organisations that do incredibly important work.
Oh, my God. That is my nightmare, being bitten by a snake in long grass, just quietly. Matthew, in your acknowledgements, you cite a number of non-fiction works as being inspiration for Black River, including Michelle McNamara's I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which I also really enjoyed as the most incredible piece of work, which, is, if you don't know, is about the hunt for the Golden State Killer. Can you maybe talk a little bit about what you found so interesting about that and how you kind of married that idea in with your setting to come up with your character of BMK?
Yeah, so these are non-fiction works. There's another one called Unbelievable, which turned into a sort of a miniseries.
So good.
Which was actually a long-form work of journalism about a serial rapist who was moving across sort of jurisdictional boundaries in the US, and one set of cops didn't really talk to the other, so it just kept going on. So I will come to I'll Be Gone in the Dark, but the thing that I found interesting in Unbelievable was in this sort of world now of DNA and everything, you'd think that people couldn't actually get away with this type of thing. But the fellow who was the perpetrator was former military and had schooled himself by reading the forensics textbooks that the police were trained with. So he was not so much a step ahead, but basically he was in the game with the police, and he'd be taking sheets with him from beds and all this sort of thing. I'll Be Gone in the Dark was a little bit different because it's set so much earlier, because the killer was active in the 70s, really, and then the 80s. It was a very interesting case if you don't know about it. It's not one of those names that sort of resonates like Son of Sam or Ted Bundy or any of those, but he'd started out as a fetish burglar, they called him, in America, in a certain sort of area of Sacramento, and he'd be breaking into houses and sort of taking something and just going through people's stuff. He might take one earring from a pair and things. And he escalated over time to become a rapist and then a killer. So I was interested in that sort of escalatory nature of it. And when there's a psychiatrist working with the police in Black River, and the police are thinking, look, we're looking, maybe we should be looking for a rapist, a serial rapist. And the psychiatrist is saying, yeah, well, maybe we could even wind back a step. And that idea that there's no DNA around, so what I think they do is start to geographically profile. So they'll look, okay, we had something here and here and here, and what does that tell us? I mean, is this someone coming in, or is it someone who knows this area and lives here? And so they try and define their search parameters in that way. And also in I'll Be Gone in the Dark and the Golden State Killer, he was moving around in causeways and sort of drainage ditches. And this is the 70s, where a new type of architecture had just come on in this area, and people were starting to build the sort of open plan houses with no curtains and, you know, onto your back sort of patio. And so he was using all that to be looking in. I think he was a great... you know, one for watching and planning and all of that. So I've really tried to get a bit of that into this obviously fictional narrative, but that's what I was calling on, those sort of things.
Oh, and it's very, very intricate, your book. It's so detailed. And I mean, I feel personally quite intimidated by the thought of writing any kind of procedural, just because of the level of detail that you need. I mean, how did you achieve that? Did you have like a police contact to read through it? How did you, when you were a journalist, did you come into contact with those people? Like, how did you achieve that level of detail?
It's quite bizarre, actually, because my brain doesn't work in this way at all. So I would never do, say, even a jigsaw puzzle or, you know, or any of that. I'm just not interested. My sister is very interested. You know, those escape rooms and all of that? No. So how I managed this, I'm not really sure, but I did talk to police a lot. And I also didn't know where the book was going. So it was literally sit down, here's where we are in this scene and what would the police do in this scene or the journalists do, and move from one step to the other. Having said that, it did take about 12 drafts and 4 years to do it. But I mean, I know in the genre people talk about, you know, pantsers or plotters. So do you plot it out on your whiteboard or do you fly by the seat of your pants? I was flying by the seat of my pants. And I mean, in the first draft at 30,000 words, I didn't know who the killer was. I had no idea. I suppose I might get stuck on something or not stuck, but thinking what would the police do. So then I would go back to a police detective and have a chat again. But then also you don't want to turn it into something turgid about, you know, how, I mean, a story about how the police really work might actually be a bit boring as they're sitting down on Tuesday morning having their coffee, you know. So you need to wear that stuff lightly, but I did find that it helped me move things along.
So interesting. I want to talk a bit about the sort of ethics of crime writing. And I mean, all of these books are exceptionally, they're so engrossing, they're so enjoyable. You know, they're books that you can really get lost in. But they all explore some really weighty and urgent themes, and that you know, there's a lot of darkness in there as well. And they're also all discussing in some way this, you know, they're discussions of the stories that we tell, the stories we consume about ourselves and about the world, and how, you know, both can be helpful and harmful. James, Denizen contains some extremely dark and confronting subject matter. But yet, you know, when I first said to you, I'm reading it, you know, I'm reading it on my holiday, and you're like, oh, I hope it's not too bleak a beach read for you. And I'm telling you, I could not put it down. It's isn't it weird how, you know, sometimes the darkest of books can be the most enjoyable? I mean, I'm a bit of a horror junkie personally, but like I find it some kind of wizardry, you know, how you manage to make something so that could be seen to be so bleak, to be so propulsive and so, you know, you can't put it down. So tell me a little bit how you go about crafting a compelling narrative from such dark material, and what responsibility you feel that you have to the reader in terms of satisfying them, by which I mean, you know, with regards to whether or not you felt like you had to tone anything down or maybe even amplify anything, or, you know, in terms of turning that dark material into something that somebody would enjoy.
This was something I wrestled with the whole 6 years I was writing Denizen, and that's because I knew that it's a bleak book in places, it's a dark book. A really good friend of mine read it in a really early iteration, and he said, if I'd bought this at Sydney Airport for a flight to London, I'd have killed myself at Hong Kong. Which, and I was like, good, that's what I'm going for. Which I don't think was the right response. But that was really good feedback, because it made me realise I'm leaning too far into the, you know, it was angry and it was cynical, and I was writing that bleakness and that darkness because I felt angry about it and because it felt important. I know that, and it's hard to talk about this without spoilers, that the ending has divided people, and I know that the ending, and I always knew that the ending was going to be divisive, and the ending was almost the first thing I decided on when I started writing the book, because it felt incredibly important to me that it rang true. And to my mind, the narrative of Denizen can really only end the way that it does. And prior to it winning the Penguin Literary Prize, when it was shortlisted, I had a phone call from an agent in Sydney who was interested in seeing it, and I sent it to her, and, you know, we spoke on the phone, and she said, I really enjoyed this, I thought it was brilliant, but I think you need to change the ending because no one's going to pick it up with such a dark ending. And I thought seriously about that, because you know, as much as I want to be someone who has, who writes something because it feels important to me and sticks to that, I'm also aware that there's no point being passionate about something like mental health in the bush and wanting to share these stories if no one's ever going to read it. But what I decided was the people that I grew up with and that I know, you know, from where I grew up, they've not had the opportunity to have the things that happen to them be toned down because it's unpalatable. And to do that, you know, in a narrative feels like such a cop-out. And, you know, how ridiculous of me to change something to make it more palatable when, like I say, the people that I know and grew up with, they've not had that choice. And my point being, I recognise that it's a dark book in places, but I hope that anyone reading it will be able to see that that's to an end. It's for a purpose. I don't want to write misery porn. I don't want to write something that's bleak for the sake of being bleak. I hope that the parts that are confronting read as if they are confrontation intentionally, because I think the best literature, and I am by no means putting myself in that category, but the best literature does that. It confronts and it unsettles and it recalibrates. And I hope that that's what the darkest bits of Denizen do, and that they do it, you know, for a cause.
Yeah, they absolutely do. And I think as well, what you do really nicely is you utilise language in such a way. I mean, it's so beautifully written. There is such beauty in the writing. But I think you also kind of you use these kind of recognizable genre tropes. You know, you're actually drawing from lots of different genres in order to you know, put those narrative removes in place so that we're not, you know, it is kind of thrilling at points. Like like I said, you draw from lots of different places, and I certainly don't want to describe it as it's not a horror novel at all, but there are little moments that feel like they've come from a horror novel or like a horror movie. And for me, that's perfect, because that's why we watch and consume those stories, in order to put that remove in place. And I think that's just done so masterfully. Shelley, your book, so, you know, true crime plays such a pivotal role in Wake, and interspersed through the main narrative are excerpts from fictional amateur sleuth web forums. Can you tell us a bit about why you wanted to include those and explore that aspect, and what kind of research that you did into that world?
Yeah, certainly. Because it was really the opposite direction for me. Is I started with those forums not intending to be doing research to write a crime fiction novel. I was just in one of those internet rabbit holes that you fall down sometimes. I was on one of those forums reading about true crime. And so it was about a 2-week period where I was just, you know, reading all of this, and it's fascinating stuff. Like, you can really see why true crime is so popular. And this was at the time just before the Golden State Killer was captured, actually. So it's really interesting that you mentioned that he's not particularly well known, because on those forums he was like the number one topic of interest, because he's the sort of person that fascinates them. That case had so many maps and codes and puzzles. And I'm sorry, I've gone off on a tangent from the question, but so I was reading all of these, and I just slowly started to bother me what I was seeing, and the way that people, real human beings, were being spoken about in these spaces. Because when it's so easy to get into an echo chamber and become a bit detached from what is actually appropriate. And so I was reading about the sibling of a murder victim, and if I said their name, you would know who it is. And they were talking about them and saying, look, you know, they don't really have much of a public web presence. I can't find an Instagram. I can't find a Facebook account. You know, there's nothing. But they do have a LinkedIn. So I know where they work, and their employer has an open Facebook account. And I went in and I looked at their Christmas party photos, and this is what I found. And I was just sitting there and I was like, that is a human being. That is a human being who suffered an incredible loss. And if that was me, I would be so angry. And from that anger, that was really where the Mina McCreary character came from. And so, so really from there, the story very much unrolled from that moment and that experience of reading those forums. But it also put me in a really interesting position when you talk about the ethics of writing crime, because I was critiquing true crime as entertainment, but also engaging in it. So am I just perpetuating the exact same thing that I'm trying to criticize here? And that was always something I was always trying to really walk the tightrope and always check in with myself, is this ethical? You know, am I being a hypocrite here? And I'm hopeful that it's come to a place where I've walked that line right. And yes.
Well, what conclusions did you draw about that, though?
Look, I think ultimately the difference is that Wake is entirely fiction. And there are a huge variety of opinions in crime fiction writing about what is and isn't appropriate to draw from real life when you're writing crime fiction. I mean, I know that there's one Australian crime fiction writer who feels that anything is fair game because the families of the victims aren't going to read crime fiction anyway. So I sort of set some rules for myself just to figure out what I felt was appropriate. And things like that I drew from a wide variety of cases. A detail here, a detail there. You could never track anything back to a specific case. So it was entirely fictional in that way. And there was also an interesting thing that happened in the months leading up to the release of Wake. There was a disturbingly similar real-life abduction that happened. And so I sort of had to sit down and think, all right, what point do I pull the plug on this if the outcome of this is tragic? And like, I won't say the name because she deserves to be forgotten and live as an anonymous person. But you know, she was found alive, which was an amazing outcome. And you know, still, that's a very tragic thing to happen, and she'll live with the after effects of that. But you know, I was, you know, having the conversation of like, do we change details so that this doesn't seem like I'm pulling from this real life case, which obviously would have been impossible with the timing, but people don't really understand just how long the lead-ins on books can be.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I never even thought about that. Yeah, that would have been hard. Hey, listen, we are, I can't believe, like, time just goes so fast when we're talking about these things. I can't believe the hour is nearly up. So we will be taking questions in just one moment. So make sure that if you do have anything to say or to ask, have it ready, and our lovely volunteers will be down with a microphone. I just want to ask Matthew, Black River is so super pacey and so twisty, and it's brilliantly written. I think your writing is so taut and tight and so pithy as well. Like, you know, you've got this journalistic flair that really comes through and makes it so enjoyable. But it looks at themes of wealth, of privilege, of institutional and systemic corruption. And there are some truly vile characters, including a serial killer who targets women, right? So do you consider it to be a crime writer's responsibility to comment or subvert or to push boundaries or challenge accepted narratives? Or do you think that our only responsibility is just to write a good story?
Probably a bit of both, actually. I think true crime is on a much thinner edge. Black River is first and foremost, and hopefully, an entertainment, and that's what it's designed to be. And a bit like Shelley said, as a journalist, I did cover the odd case, and there's very small details that I've used, but you would never track it back. And even with this sort of Golden State Killer stuff, you know, not that a victim, I'd imagine, a rape victim from the Golden State Killer would bother to read it, but if they did, they wouldn't resonate with them in any way. So that's where I, you know, it's a bit of a cop out to say it, but it is fiction and no one gets hurt. But it is also pulled from life, and I think that's, so the question then becomes, why do we find it interesting and entertaining? And I think it's a sort of a psychological thing that, you know, the people who are doing things in Black River, people like that have existed and do exist. And so it's a sort of extremity of psychology. And I think as human beings, we find that interesting because the people doing it are, in the end, human beings, and similar things have happened. Having said that, something like In Cold Blood, which I read at university, you know, is this great sort of piece of reportage. I went back to that, and I actually think that book I don't think it'd be published now, and I don't think it should be published now. Because what it does, it's got this clutter family who are murdered, and what Capote does is, before they're murdered, he goes into the head of a 15-year-old girl on this farm who's baking a cake the day before. Now, this is a real person who has cousins and people who are still alive, who was slaughtered in her home, and he's in her head the day before, somewhere he can't possibly be. He doesn't know what she was thinking. You know, he'd never met her alive. And I don't think that that's acceptable.
Thank you for that answer. I've got like 6 pages of material, guys. Like, I'm so devastated. It's gone so quickly. If anybody would like to ask a question, as I said, are wonderful. I've got the house lights coming up so we can see you all. Hello. If anyone does have a question. Yes, we've got a lady down the front here. Just wait for the microphone to come to you. Thank you so much. Oh, very good. Yeah. What are you working on next, guys?
Yeah, so I have another book coming out this year. It's actually at the proofreading stage now. So it's very close to being finished, which is a big relief. It'll be out August 31st, and it is also crime fiction, sort of a semi-sequel to Wake. There are some characters that continue, but it can also be read if you haven't read it. So I would strongly recommend reading Wake first, but it's not a prerequisite.
Is that because it follows the characters on from the events of Wake?
It follows some of the characters, and some needed a break. but it is called Ripper, and it's out August 31st.
Fantastic. Good on you. Matthew?
I'm actually very similar to Shelley in that I'm writing a second book of a series, so it's not a sequel, so you wouldn't have to read Black River beforehand, but it takes the female police detective from Black River, and she's working with another woman who's introduced in the book, and they've sort of partnered up, really. And they're actually working with a pathologist out of Newcastle and sort of towards Cessnock. And it's the first draft is almost done, and I think it'll come out August, but next year. So,
excellent, good job, James.
I'm very flattered and honoured to be on this panel because I am not a crime writer, and I have so much admiration for these guys for being able to write these books. I think Denizen straddles a few genres, and one of them is crime, and I'm very, very honoured to be included here. But the next book that I'm working on is decidedly not crime. I definitely won't be being asked to come on this panel with the next book. The book I'm preparing to send off at the moment is a novel about mental health, but more specifically it's about mental illness and physical illness and the way they interact and the concept of euthanasia in each. So a lot of my nursing has been in palliative care. I'm fascinated by the conversations around euthanasia and around the really interesting and I think quite disturbing and distressing ways mental illness can be interpreted through that lens, particularly given voluntary assisted dying is going to be made legal in November at the end of this year. I think it's a really, I'm hoping it will be something that will contribute something to that conversation.
Can I ask you really quickly, how would you classify your book?
Oh God. I don't, maybe psychological thriller? A crime? To me, a crime book needs, Ashley Clayton Blunt, who I do the podcast with, she was like, oh, it's a crime book, it's got a crime in it. I was like, yeah, Pride and Prejudice has got a crime in it, doesn't mean it's a crime book. Psychological fiction, I'd be happy with that, I suppose.
Oh my God, don't even, we've got no time to talk about genre, really, I'm so fascinated by it. Is there anybody else that has anything that they want to ask? I could go on and on. How about, why don't you, like, it can be a bit of a rude shock for some debut novelists when they start working with publishers and editors. How has your experience been, all three of you, just quickly, and what have you learned, do you think, through the editorial process that you're carrying on into your second books?
I can answer that. I had an incredible experience. I'm so, so lucky. I worked with Penguin Random House and an editor named Johannes Jacob, who was just incredible. I learned so much from the editing process. I think what I learned was there is always so much to learn. And how incredibly humbling and how lucky I am to be having these people being paid to look over my work and help make it better. That was my takeaway, how lucky I am.
Yeah, I agree with that, actually. I do think, if you're being edited, it's horrible, the process, in a way, but it's also wonderful, because you do sense that they've got your back and they do want to make the book work as well as it possibly can. So I worked with a woman called Meredith Rose, who's quite a famous sort of Australian fiction editor, before I found a publisher. And we got the book knocked into shape over several years, and then she said, I think it's ready to send out. Because really, you don't want to be sending your book to a publisher until it's as good as you can possibly get it, because they're probably only going to look at it once. So that's how it happened, and then Alan and Unwin bought it, and of course it was edited in-house by their editors, which was also good, but a lot of the work by then had been done. But I had a publisher at Allen Unwin, a fellow called Tom Gilliatt, who was the publishing director, and he just happened to love the book, so he sort of grabbed it by the scruff of the neck, and they really got behind it. So that's not always the case, I think, so it was wonderful for me as well.
Shall we?
Yeah, I've had just an incredible experience with Hachette, and being edited is genuinely enjoyable, because if you get a good editor, and I think that it's really unfortunate that editors' names really only appear in the acknowledgements, because there are just some incredible ones working in Australia who have so much to do with the success of books in their final form, and it would be great if their names were better known. And so it's really unfortunate that I'm so bad with names and can't reel off all of the amazing editors that worked on my book. But it's just incredible, some of the attention to detail that they have and the things that they pick up on. And, if I hadn't had that assistance and expertise, then Wake would be riddled with utes that teleport from one side of the farm to the other and just all sorts of things. So it's been a wonderful experience.
Yeah, the collaborative part of writing is my favourite bit. I love it when the people come in and we can start talking. Oh God, like I said, I've got so many more questions I want to ask you, but I'll have to save them for the green room because we are out of time. I just want to thank you all for coming and for listening to these authors to speak. Their books are magnificent. They're really, really great, and I do urge you all to go and buy a copy. They will be signing books afterwards, and I forgot to ask the volunteers, will they be signing back over at New Space or here? Great. So just out the downstairs where you came in, and their books are for sale out there as well. Grab yourself a copy of each. Treat yourselves. Thank you so much to the entire Newcastle Writers Festival team for having us today, to our wonderful volunteers. We really appreciate the work that you do, and to the sound people up there. Thank you so much for the microphone. And to Matthew, Shelley and James for such a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for joining us and for being so open and vulnerable and eloquent with your answers. We'll see you all next year. Thank you, guys.
I hope you enjoyed this session, which was recorded at the 2023 Festival. Save the date for next year's event, which is going to be held from April 5 to 7. Special mention to Create New South Wales, who have supported this podcast series.
Stories to you.